All right, welcome back to part two. So, continuing on here in our discussion, we're going to look into what the legal grounds for divorce in the first century were, where the husband would legally be able to divorce his wife and would thus be able to keep that the ketubah. Beyond what was already stated, there was some verses, because what we talked about before was out of the Torah. Or what it was out of the oral Torah, sorry. And this is stuff that all groups, including the Essenes, the Sadducees, and all the Pharisees, they all, it was commonly agreed on these things. And then we'll look at some of the disagreements here. So the first thing we have to understand is a exegetical rule that is used today. It's used in all cultures, and it was definitely used back in the first century in order to interpret the Torah and to interpret the readings. And what this is called Kol Vahomer, and this is an argument from major to minor. What they're saying is that if this case is true, this minor case is true, then or the, you know this case that seems very obscure, or whatever, then this also must be true for other cases. So basically, like this is what we're talking about in Exodus 21. Remember, Exodus 21 gives the laws for a slave woman who is the her husband, a slave wife. If her husband takes on a second wife, she is still entitled to this, 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 and this. And if not, she is to be, or she's able to be divorced, and she gains her freedom from that. Because remember, this slave girl, she was most likely put into slavery because of a debt that needed to be paid off. So what they're saying is that if this slave woman has the right to basically be set free if her husband mistreats her in such a way, then obviously these, if a free woman, or if any, even, or if the man himself is mistreated in this manner, he obviously has the right to divorce his wife as well. So remember, these things were all completely accepted by all three main branches in Judaism. Everyone in Judea in the first century all accepted these things. And we're going to go back. Well, let's read Exodus 21, verse 10 through 11, real fast here. So Exodus 21, I'm reading out of the Scriptures 1998 version, verse 10 and 11. If he takes another wife, her, and this is talking about a man who is married to a slave woman, or a servant woman, if he takes another wife, her food, her covering, and her marital rights are not to be diminished. The rights of that slave wife are not to be diminished. If he does not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for naught without silver. So she doesn't gain any money. She doesn't get a higher settlement, but her whatever her debt was that she had to go into slavery for to begin with is complete. That debt record is completely wiped clean. And then, of course, the other one, we'll turn there real fast, Genesis 1, verse 28. Genesis 1, verse 28. And Elohim blessed them, and Elohim said to them, bear fruit and increase, and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over all the creatures moving on the earth. So it was understood and recognized in the time that that there were several reasons for that were valid grounds for divorce. Failure to produce a child within 10 years. Now, this didn't mean that in this specific case, the woman would not lose her ketubah, because they didn't know who's, what the problem was there, possibly a problem with the matchmaking in their minds. But failure to produce a child within 10 years, they were expected to divorce, and they would be forced to divorce. Lack of food. If, you know that I didn't have it here, but in the Mishnah, there's the woman must grind X number of whatever the measurement of flour is per day, and the husband, is actually required to give his wife a certain rationing of food each day. And in fact, if he leaves on business, he's required to provide a certain number of food, amount of food. Lack of clothing. We already talked about the woman was required to spin wool. And so she would have a certain amount of clothing she was required to produce. And likewise, the husband was required to provide her with the means of getting that clothing. And then lack of love, which was kind of defined a little bit differently within each group. And we already saw that, you know, how House of Shammai and House of Hillel ruled on the amount of time you can go without conjugal relationships. But this was basically, I understand, twofold. First off, it was a requirement for conjugal duties with, you know, every certain amount of time, as we talked about before. And then it was also seen as a prohibition against physical abuse. Because when you look at Genesis 21, the wording there is kind of hard to translate. So they're not really sure what that lack of love is actually speaking of. So they define it as sexual relationships and prohibition, obviously, against physical abuse. Because, you know, it's generally accepted everywhere that physical abuse is grounds for divorce. However, you know, as I talked about before, this has been misunderstood by, for example, the Catholic Church. They basically said you can't divorce for any reason. And so there's many women who were abused throughout the years, who were, you know, essentially shamed not into divorcing their husbands because they thought it was against the commandments of God. All right, so now let's look at what is the most important part of cultural understanding in the Mishnah to understanding the words of Yeshua. And it comes from Mishnah Tractate Gittin 9.10. And it reads, Beit Shammai says, a man should not divorce his wife unless he has found her guilty of some unseemly conduct. As it says, because he has found some unseemly thing in her. Beit Hillel, however, says he may divorce her even if she has merely spoilt his food, since it says, because he hath found some unseemly thing in her. Rabbi Akiba says he may divorce her even if he finds another woman more beautiful than she is, as it says, it cometh to pass, she has found no favor in his eyes. So this is what we're dealing with here in the first century, is that Beit Shammai, the house of Shammai, ruled that on Deuteronomy 24, as that we talked about in the previous video, or the previous part in this series, is that in Deuteronomy 24, Shammai interpreted this as saying that he may divorce his wife if he's found an unseemly thing in her, something related to either sexual misconduct or adultery itself, that gives him the right to divorce her. However, and you can see this a little bit more clearly if you look at the same conversation in the Tosefta, but what this is talking about here is Beit Hillel ruled that it wasn't, it didn't say a matter of uncleanliness. Hillel said it was if he finds any matter or an uncleanliness in her. So according to Beit Hillel, which just, you know, Beit Shammai, the house of Shammai was essentially a very conservative branch of Judaism in the first century, whereas Hillel was a much more liberal branch of Judaism. And what Hillel ruled on was that a man can divorce his wife for any matter, even if she just merely burns his food, he can go ahead and divorce her. And then this Rabbi Akiba, who I believe he was in the second century of the Common Era, he said even if he just sees a woman more beautiful than his wife, he can divorce her because the Torah says she has found no favor in his eyes. You know, which is obviously, we understand, is obviously not the intent, but this was a very real interpretation in their time, and what it led to was a culture where a woman could be divorced for any reason, basically. Because a rabbinic court was basically just three rabbis, right? So let's say you wanted to divorce your wife. What do you do? Because, you know, you're sick of her and you just want to divorce her. Well, you go find three rabbis who are under the house of Hillel, and you go up to them and you basically fill out your divorce paperwork and you're divorced. Whereas if you went to a Shammite, a house of Hillel rabbi, you would need to prove that she had committed some sort of indecent act, much like when we talked about the in Mishnah Sotah, the trial by bitter waters, right? If you had two witnesses that proved that she committed adultery, or that she went out and was you know, secretly talking to a man in public, or was out in public with her hair undone, then that would be valid grounds to divorce your wife, but that had to be proven, right? Well, now here's the problem. Hillel, you know, you could go to a house of, you could be under the house of Shammai, and you could go to a Hillel rabbi and get your divorce and then go remarry a woman of the house of who believed, you know, the theology of the house of Shammai, because Shammai, even though they disagreed with Hillel, they still honored the rulings of the that house. All right, so the last thing that we need to do before we get into the words of Yeshua is to actually talk about how we are to understand Yeshua's words, how we're to understand the Gospels in the context that the Gospels were written in. You know, we've already clearly established the culture at the time, but we have to look at how the Gospels themselves were actually written. Now, this may come as a surprise to you, hopefully not, but Yeshua actually spoke the language and the dialect of the people of his day. He did not come there and speak ancient biblical Hebrew. He came and he spoke what is known today as like Mishnaic Hebrew, which was it's Hebrew, but it's an Aramaicized version. The syntaxes, just, you know, the sentence structure, all that stuff was a little bit changed, and some of the idioms had changed. A great example of that, something that I'm currently working on right now for a teaching, is how they understood sin. If you look at the Torah, primarily throughout the Torah, sin is referred to as a burden that has to be borne, right? When Cain killed Abel, he said, the weight of my sin is more than I can bear. So sin was thought of as a burden. Now, when we get to the first century times, basically after the Babylonian exile, they had integrated the languages. And so the terminology had changed a little bit. No longer was sin referred to as a burden. It was now referred to as a debt, which is why we see, for example, what's known as the Lord's Prayer, right? When Yeshua teaches his disciples how to pray, he teaches them to pray, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, right? So, you know, it's the same language, but the idioms have changed. It's a little bit different. So we have to understand that Yeshua spoke in a way that the people of his day would understand. The next thing we've got to also realize is that there was not a scribe there writing down everything that Yeshua did. His words, actually, the Gospels were not actually written down until many years after his death. So we've got to look at how were the Gospels actually transmitted up till the point where they were recorded on paper. Well, to do that, we look at the method that the Mishnah is recorded in, and, you know, the Tosefta's and all the ancient works. We look at how they did this. And the same guy who wrote this book on marriage, David Enstone Brewer, he also wrote another book that talks about, you know, the methods that they used. And so basically what they would do is after the rabbi would teach them some, all of the disciples would come together and they would discuss what had just been taught, and they would try to reduce it down to the simplest form possible, and then they would balance out the sentence so that it was much easier to remember. So what stuff would they remove to simplify it? Well, they would remove anything that was that would have been obvious to the people in that day and time. So a modern day example of this. Let's say that I'm trying to tell you a story about what I did, and I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and let's say that that I was going to tell you that I drove to Chicago for a conference, for example. Well, that right there is enough message for you to understand that when I said I drove to Chicago, that implies that I took time off of work. I put gas in my car. I turned my car on. You know, I backed out of my driveway. I had a map or a GPS. All of this stuff, when I say the simple sentence, I drove to Chicago, your mind automatically connects all those dots along the way of how I got to that conclusion. Well, the same thing was what was happening in the first century. When Yeshua spoke, you know, used certain phrases, people would automatically connect that with the arguments that were going on within the various branches of Judaism in that day, or things that were automatically understood, didn't need to be reiterated. That's why Yeshua didn't have to come and reiterate every single one of the commandments in the Torah, is because people already knew them. There's no need to reiterate such commandments. So we have to understand that. And then the other important thing is that, you know, we've got four different gospels, and there's a little bit of differentiation between them. And some people find that hard to, they try to go out and they try to reconcile everything together. Well, you know, maybe there's some merit to that, but it really isn't that important. And here's why. Each of those gospels was written to a different audience. Right, we know that Luke's gospel was written to Theophilus, who is believed to be the high priest after the sometime between before the fall of the first or the second temple and Yeshua's death. Sometime in there, that there's a priest named Theophilus. We know that the gospel of Matthew was originally called the gospel to the Hebrews, and it was written to, you know, the Hebrews, obviously. John's gospel is written in a more mystical type. I'm blanking on the word. Sod level, you know, it has numerology involved, and you know it's a deeper meaning to some of the stuff there. So each gospel was kind of intended for a different audience. So there's a different emphasis on each thing. So with that in mind, let's now look into the words of Yeshua. All right, so what we're going to do right now is I'm going to first read all the way through Matthew 19, verse 1 through 12, which is Yeshua's main ruling on marriage. And I want to read through it first, and then we're going to go back and we're going to analyze it piece by piece. Remember, the Gospel of Matthew was written to the Hebrews. It was written to people who understood the arguments, the problems in the first century. All right, so Matthew 19, verse 1. And it came to be, when Yeshua had ended these words, that he left Galil, or Galilee, and came to the borders of Yehuda beyond the Jordan. And a large crowd followed him, and he healed them there. And the Pharisees came to him, trying him, saying, "Is it right for a man to put away his wife for any reason?" And he answered and said to them, "Did you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, 'For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore what Elohim has joined together, let not man separate.' They said to him, 'Why then did Moshe command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away?' And he said to them, 'Because of the hardness of your hearts, Moshe allowed you to put away your wives, but it was not so from the beginning. And I say to you, whoever puts away his wife, except on grounds of whoring or adultery, and marries another, commits adultery. And whoever marries her who has been put away commits adultery.' His taught ones said to him, 'If such is the case, of the man with his wife, it is not good to marry. And he said to them, not all receive this word, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born so from their mothers' wombs. There were eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men. And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of the heavens. He who is able to receive it, let him receive it. So let's analyze this verse by verse. The first thing that we come to is the Pharisees came to him trying him, right? So they were testing Yeshua when they come up to him and they say this. And they say to him, is it right for a man to put away his wife for any reason, any matter? Now, what would have come to the mind of the first century reader immediately upon this? Remember the trip to Chicago mentality here. What is the first thing you're going to think of? Putting away, divorce, and put away is an idiom for divorce. Put away divorce your wife for any matter. Well, of course, they're going to immediately go to that same argument that was between the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai that's recorded in Mishnah Gittin 9.10. They're going to think, the Pharisees are asking him, who is right? Is Hillel right that we can divorce our wife for any reason? Or is Shammai right? So they're asking him, which one of these is right? And they're referencing specifically Deuteronomy 24, verse 1. They are not asking him to rule whether Exodus 21:10 is valid grounds for divorce, because that was already established, and they would have had to specify, you know, is it okay for a man to divorce his wife for lack of food, for lack of clothing, for lack of love? Is that okay? Right, but they didn't ask him that. They were specifically pointing to Deuteronomy 24, verse 1. And a couple little things with this. This divorce for any matter required a returning of the dowry, but the money that, remember what I talked about, the man has to give the wife back her dowry, but if she had made money during their marriage, that's all his, other than that one-third or two-thirds that goes there. An example that Mr. Instone Brewer brings out in his book here is that in Islamic countries, to divorce a woman, a man must merely say, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. So if he was in his country and heard, or if he was in this country, in the U.S., and he hears that that's not a valid ground of divorce, he may go to his imam, his spiritual leader, and say, is it lawful for me to divorce my wife in this country? And that he's not asking for any reason. He would be specifically asking, is it lawful, you know, using this formula that we have in our countries? So we see here clearly that this is not a end all. They're asking him, is the only ground valid grounds for divorce, is it only through adultery? They're specifically asking about Deuteronomy 24, and everyone would have realized this is not referring to Exodus 21. That Yeshua never actually gives a ruling on whether it's okay to divorce your wife or your husband if they are basically physically or emotionally abusing you. So the next part we come to is Yeshua answers and said, did you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh, so that they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, whatever Elohim has joined together, let not man separate. So this is very interesting. Why did Yeshua ask this question in this manner? Right? They asked if there's any reason for a divorce, and Yeshua, you know, kind of sidesteps the question there and talks about the two becoming one flesh. Now, this is really interesting here. Did you know that Yeshua here is actually quoting the Septuagint and not the Masoretic text? The Masoretic text actually changed what Genesis said. In the Septuagint, it says the two shall become one flesh, whereas the Masoretic says, and they shall become one flesh. And the reason there is in the Jewish mindset, when it says the two shall become one flesh, that's this whole thing here was actually used as proof text by the Essenes for monogamy, because the Essenes did not believe at all in polygamy. This was one of their main proof texts. Whereas we see now the Masoretes come, and for whatever reason, they changed the wording there in Genesis to reflect this idea that polygamy is possibly okay. So the question is, does Yeshua's words here, right here, does this negate divorce? No. This is not negating divorce. All this is stating is that he's saying, therefore, what Elohim has joined together, let not man separate. That's not saying you can't get divorced. It's just saying no one should come in and drive a wedge in that marriage and do that. It's still saying that divorce is possible. It's just saying it's not the ideal. This is not what God intended from the beginning. Because, you know, and some of you might say, well, Ryan, where are you getting that from? Well, I can show you in, I don't have the exact verse, but remember in Ezra's time, they were actually commanded to put away their foreign wives. Well, if God did not want you to ever divorce, why would he have told them to put away their foreign wives? And also we've got the case of Abraham. Remember, Abraham and Sarah were married, and then she has him marry Hagar to produce Ishmael. And then later on, because of strife, she asks him to divorce Hagar, and God basically sides with Sarah and says, you need to listen to your wife and send this woman away. So clearly, you know, in the Torah and in the historical writings in the Tanakh, we see a precedent set for God, you know, okaying divorce in certain scenarios. So we've got to make a clear distinction there. All right. They said to him, why then did Moshe command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? Now, you know, we know that the Pharisees have added many things to the Torah. So here's the question. Did Moses actually command this certificate of divorce to be given if she committed adultery? Did you know that in the first century in Judaism that, you know, let's say that your wife, and you're in the first century, and your wife goes out and she forgets to put on her head covering, and several witnesses see her. Well, they would then go report that to the rabbis, and even if the husband did not want to divorce his wife because of this, or even if she committed adultery, there was no room for forgiveness, there was no room for repentance, any of that stuff. What would happen is they would actually, you know, they would beat the husband, they would fine him, they would do all these things until he divorced his wife, even if he didn't want to. So, you know, in their mindset, they believed that they had to, you know, that this law about divorce was an absolute. It wasn't just a, if he feels the need to divorce her because of her actions, that in infidelity, that he can do so. No, instead, they left out any possibility of reconciliation between the two. The next verse, and Yeshua's response, Yeshua says, because of the hardness of your hearts, Moshe allowed you to put away your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. And I say to you, whoever puts away his wife, except for grounds of whoring, and marries another, commits adultery. And whoever marries her who has been put away commits adultery. Okay, so you know, right here, right off the bat, the rabbis believed it was commanded, and what does Yeshua said? Say, he said he allowed for it, right? All of these matters, even when you look at Exodus 21, the lack of food, lack of love, and lack of clothing, all of these things don't mean that you have to divorce your wife. What's being spoken of here is if, you know, you confront your wife or your husband and they refuse to change their ways in adultery, in physical abuse, in neglect, in emotional abuse, all of these things, if they refuse to change their ways, you have the right to divorce them so that you don't have to suffer through these things. Because, you know, obviously God doesn't want us to have to suffer through things because of someone else's actions. So he provides Israelites with a way of getting out of the bad situation that they, if they themselves cannot help that situation. Now this is really interesting. He finishes up, whoever marries her who has been put away commits adultery. Remember, this is all in the context of that Hillel ruling that you can divorce your wife for any matter. And remember earlier I talked about, while the house of Shammai did not allow for a divorce for any matter, they did allow for a remarriage after such a divorce occurred. So while Yeshua here is very harshly coming out against the house of Hillel's ruling, he is also stating that those of the house of Shammai who allow remarriage to someone who has been put away in such a manner, they themselves are now forcing her to commit adultery. And also, you know, it's also kind of pinning the fault on whoever the guilty party is. Whoever initiated this divorce for any matter is going to be the one culpable for causing their spouse to commit adultery if such a thing were to occur. So the last little part we've got to analyze here is what, you know, his disciples, they say to him, if such is the case with the man and his wife, it is not even good to marry. And Yeshua's response is kind of strange. He says, for there are eunuchs who are born from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who are made eunuchs by men. And there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Now, is Yeshua advocating castration here? No. You know, if you understand the culture and the mindset of Judaism in that day, that would have been an even harder statement on anyone hearing that. Because in the minds of the rabbis at the time, I think it's a very valid point. They believed that any sort of physical mutilation is basically marring the image of God, because we are created in the image of God, right? So if you were to do something that would remove that, that would be a very bad thing, right? And if you look at the Torah supports this sort of idea, right? The priests have to be, they can't be physically defective. So if we're all supposed to be priests, is Yeshua really saying that some people have to castrate themselves for the kingdom of heaven's sake? No. We've got to understand the metaphors and the euphemisms in the first century. He's not talking about necessarily talking about, I mean, now this would include people who were made, you know, who are made this way. But what he's talking about here is people who cannot reproduce an heir. Because what is a eunuch? A eunuch is someone who is unable to produce children. And remember what I talked about, what was one of the commandments that they perceived in the first century? They perceived the commandment that was that you have to be fruitful and multiply, that it is it's actually one of the most important commands that you actually have a child. And so if after 10 years a couple had not reproduced, they would actually go out and force this couple to divorce so that they would reproduce a child. And what Yeshua is saying is that, you know, some people just aren't able to reproduce, and that's okay. it's not valid grounds for divorce if you go out and you do this sort of, you know, and you're unable to produce these children. Some people are that way. And some people make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake, right? Some people simply just don't marry for whatever reason. Maybe they're called to a life of celibacy. I don't, you know, and trust me, I do not advocate that people should live a celibate life, because otherwise, right, we'd all have died out a long time ago. And I don't, I do not believe that the Torah at all implies that people who are celibate are somehow holier than those who are not. That's a very dangerous doctrine and a misdirection by the Catholic Church. And we can see the results of that, right? They've been filled with pedophiles, with priests who would sleep with nuns, and then they would throw the offspring of their union off the cliff, you know, to get rid of the evidence, right? So obviously, this is not a good doctrine. What he's talking about here is that, you know, some people can't do it, or perhaps, you know, some people, because of whatever in their life, maybe they have homosexual tendencies. Well, right here is the answer. The answer is, if you have those tendencies, you don't have to act on them. For the kingdom of heaven's sake, you can, you know, basically subdue all your emotions towards that manner and live a celibate life, rather than to live a sexually immoral lifestyle that is not in accordance with either the Old Testament or the New Testament. They're both very clear that such behavior is not acceptable to God. All right. And another verse that we can look at really quick is Matthew 5, verse 31 and 32. So we'll turn there real fast. Matthew 5, verse 31 and 32. And Yeshua says, "And it has been said, whoever puts away his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce." What is that in reference to? That is in reference to Deuteronomy 24, the requirements, let him give her a certificate of divorce. And so Yeshua says, "But I say to you that whoever puts away his wife, except for a matter of whoring, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a woman who has been put away commits adultery." So what is Yeshua saying here again? Once again, the reference here is the discussion on Deuteronomy 24. It's not talking about Exodus 21. And so Yeshua is saying here, whoever puts away, whoever uses Hillel's ruling, he makes his wife commit adultery. Now that's really interesting. What does that seem to imply? That seems to imply that if she goes out and has relationships with another man, he is now responsible for the crime that was committed. He's the one who forced her to do that. And whoever marries a woman who has been put away commits adultery. Right? So the man who is now doing that, because if basically what Yeshua is saying is that according to the heavenly court, according to Yeshua's judgment, a woman who has been divorced for any matter is not properly divorced, and therefore there is adultery being committed if she goes and is with another man. And but the thing is that the culpability, the punishment is to be placed on the husband who divorced her, right? Because he is the one who acted improperly, assuming that it wasn't some sort of mutual agreement, and then they would both be at fault. But since he is the one who put her away, he now bears that responsibility for her future actions there. So once again, this is not a prohibition on divorce. It's simply a prohibition on divorce for any reason here. So let's go ahead and summarize what Yeshua has actually ruled on marriage, now that we've looked at the actual context of what Yeshua was saying. So number one, Yeshua said monogamy, right? Only one partner at a time, is what God's intention is. He is basically siding with the Essenes here and saying that polygamy is not in accordance with God's will, because that's what the Torah is. The Torah is God's will. The second thing that Yeshua is saying in all these statements is that marriage is lifelong. It's not God's will that anyone be divorced, unless, you know, and we point out those problems. When the marriage occurred for improper reasons, then God may ask you to, but that's a little bit different because the institution was flawed from the beginning. So marriage should be lifelong. And so if a divorce occurs, one party or the other is at fault here, and therefore will have to bear the punishment and the culpability for that improper divorce action, or for the adultery that occurred, or for the abuse, or whatever. Divorce was not compulsory, right? Even if your husband cheats on you, if your wife cheats on you, Yeshua opens the door and says, there is chance for reconciliation, for forgiveness, and whatnot. He also ruled that marriage is not an absolute requirement. If for some reason you can't get married, you're not breaking God's commandments. And on top of that, if for some reason you can't produce children, you're not breaking God's commandments. You're not a sinner because you can't produce children. And then the last and the biggest thing that is being spoken of here, and it even plays out today, because what is in America today? What grounds do you need for divorce? If you don't like your wife, you guys can just agree to split up, right? And Yeshua ruled that divorce for this any matter, or for no fault, as we would call it today, no fault divorce or any matter divorce, is invalid. And if a couple chooses to get divorced in such a manner, subsequent remarriage is considered committing adultery in God's eyes. So, you know, that really answers those questions that have been put out. You know, if my spouse is abusive to me, can I divorce him? The answer, according to all of that I've researched in Scripture, if your spouse is abusive to you, if they are, you know, committing adultery, and especially if they're refusing to stop these actions, according to the Torah and according to the best interpretation I can find of Yeshua's rulings, that is valid grounds for divorce, and you do have the right to be able to get out of that situation. So we're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to come back in the third video here, and then we'll get into what Paul is talking about.